Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tortoise. Hello, welcome to Trendy from Tortoise. I'm John Curtis.
And I'm Rachel Wolfe.
We're back after an Easter break. And at the beginning of next month, everyone in England and Wales will get the chance to vote in some kind of local election. So we thought this week on Trendy we would look at the state of local democracy in Britain. How effective are local elections at holding local politicians, and particularly mayors and, if you hadn't heard of them before, police and crime commissioners to account? And how much can we read into the results at the beginning of May as an indicator for the way that voters might behave in a general election, and in particular, the prospects for the Conservatives?
So, first of all, what's happening? On May the 2nd, every single part of England and Wales will have a vote for at least one election. Around 2,600 local councillors are being elected across 107 council areas. This is where local politics, as always, gets complicated, mostly for about a third of the seats on their council, but 26 are electing all the councillors in their area. There's also the race for the Mayor of London, 25 members of the London Assembly, 37 police and crime commissioners, some of whom are also mayors, and 9 regional, what are called metro or combined metro mayors. John, your day job is studying elections, polling, public opinion, so you live and breathe this stuff.
Yes, particularly local elections, Rachel, which are a particular niche aspect of this, with, as you say, the own peculiar complexities. But anyway, before we talk about all of that and what we might look out for and prospects for the parties at the beginning of May, let's paint a broader canvas and look at the landscape of local democracy, at least in England, and focus in particularly on those two relatively recent innovations of mayors and police and crime commissioners. Why were they introduced? What do they do? How effective are they? So, Rachel, police and crime commissioners introduced in 2012. Not sure whether you were in 10 Downing Street then or not, but what was the idea behind them?
So police and crime commissioners, which, as you referred to earlier, John, are often the least well-known part of local democracy, and we'll talk about turnout in a minute, are directly elected. Sometimes they're also the mayor, sometimes they're not. And they have 3 core powers. They can appoint and fire the chief constable, the person who's actually operationally in charge of policing, as Boris Johnson did quite controversially once with Ian Blair, who was in charge of the Met. They can set the police plan for the area, so say what they think the priorities of the police can be and how they should go about it. And they can set the budget, which includes what we call a council tax precept, a chunk on top of what you pay in council tax, which provides quite a high percentage now of police funding, just over a third, although it varies massively by area.
Yeah, and I guess we should say that what these people do is they're a replacement for what used to be police authorities, which essentially would consist of a group of local councillors who perhaps, according to some of these, were not necessarily particularly expert on policing or not necessarily particularly interested in it, but which were meant to provide some accountability. And there was some concern about whether or not this really was proving to be an adequate way of democratic controls. Actually, interestingly, both the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats in the 2010 election both had this idea in their manifesto. So this was one thing they felt was a good hit, and they introduced quite quickly back in 2012.
For the Conservatives, this first came up, as far as I can tell, in a 2003 paper by David Cameron's favourite think tank, although it was before David Cameron, Policy Exchange. And it took as a model, and in opposition between 2005 and 2010, there was an increasing interest in the way that America or parts of America were dealing with policing and crime. So when I was in Conservative Central Office in sort of 2007, 2008, there'd be endless conversations about CompStat, which was the New York's method of measuring crime, their kind of for then very advanced computer system, and the broken windows theory that Bratton introduced in New York, which is kind of dealing with very low-level crimes before they become bigger crimes. So there was this real obsession in policy world, at least on the right, with how America was doing it.
Well, we'll discover later on there's a parallel here for about metro mayors as well, but we'll come back to that.
Absolutely. And one element of that is that America quite often has directly elected crime chiefs, and mayors have real power over crime. And the view was that this would increase local accountability. It would drag the police back to focusing on local priorities. So if you read that original paper, it will talk about things like people wanting to see local policemen on the beat more, wanting them to move away from certain kinds of crime and towards others. And the idea was that this would provide a forcing function for the police to be responsive to what the local population wanted. And I suppose the final thing to say is, if you look at kind of national issues, actually of all the things that local authorities look after, crime, policing is pretty high up the list. It is the thing that people care about. So this concept felt quite plausible, that people cared about crime, they wanted responsiveness to crime, they wanted to see the police respond to what they asked for, and it had worked in America. So why not introduce it here? But it's been a limited success, I think it's fair to say, wouldn't you, John?
I think it to be fair to say, certainly the idea of holding elections. So the first elections took place on a dark day in November 2012, entirely on their own. And the reaction from the public was a resounding, what's all this about? Just 15% of people turned out for posts that were not widely understood. And fairly rapidly, the government realised that maybe if we were going to have these things, then perhaps the thing to do is to ensure that they take place on the same day as the annual round of local elections. There are always local elections somewhere or other in England at the beginning of May each year. So we combine them together. And indeed, by the 2021, when they were combined with lots of local elections, actually the turnout was about 33%. However, what you can still tell that this, whether or not there are coincident elections, make a difference. So in Wales, for example, where there are four police commissioners, the last two rounds of elections, both in 2016 and 2021, coincided with the elections for the Welsh Senedd, for which turnout is over 40%. So 45% of people turned out in Wales in 2021.
It's worth saying, John, this still sounds quite low. 45% does not sound massive.
No, but point is, it's being dragged up to that level, right, by the fact that the devolved election was going on, and some people in Wales at least think that the Senedd matters. There also have there were some places in 2021, about four PCCs, where actually there weren't any local elections in 2021. And the turnout, well, it was better than the 15% in 2012, but it was still only around 26%. And the problem that the elections will face this year is that there will be more places where there aren't some kind of local election going on at the same time. There isn't a devolved election in Wales, and there are seven counties in England where there are absolutely no local elections going on. So the truth is that actually getting people to turn out for a post that even now, what, 10, 12 years on, is still not that widely known, is still proving to be even more difficult than it is getting people to turn out for devolved elections or local government elections in England.
And I guess it's an interesting question whether, you know, 12 years by the standards of local government in England is not a very long time. One of the reasons we find it hard to change local government in England is it has histories going back centuries or millennia. And it might it might evolve more over time. But what's your view, John? Do you think that these positions will become more known and more popular, or are they doomed to obscurity?
Well, I think that, to be honest, so far at least, nobody really has emerged as a police and crime commissioner who is particularly well known. And I suspect one of the reasons why now, as you alluded to earlier, in some instances, it was always the case in London, but Greater Manchester, West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, for example, the mayor has been made the police and crime commissioner, and the mayors tend to be rather better known. And that actually was quite interesting. I did actually give a talk recently to a really not terribly well-known organisation called the Association of Police and Crime Commissioners. And shall we say that I did detect a certain amount of defensiveness about the fact that turnout wasn't always that high. And they were very insistent that they really still mattered, even though if they hadn't as yet necessarily collectively particularly persuaded the electorate of their value. But they've certainly still got a task ahead of them if they are going to make much impact on the wider public.
I imagine that's a fairly frequent experience for you, John. Mild defensiveness in the face of the data that you present people. You must be quite used to it by now.
Well, indeed. Politicians of all hues occasionally suffer from the razor sharper of empirical analysis, which of course often upsets many a political presupposition. But anyway, maybe we should go on to the other innovation, relatively recent, which are mayors. This one again starts in the United States. It starts with the idea that, you know, the mayor somewhere like New York or whatever is well known, whereas leaders of local councils tend not to be terribly well known. So the argument was, and was an argument that New Labour took up, was, so therefore what we should do, we should have directly elected mayors for authorities, and they will then have the executive authority to do things. They'll be more effective than the system of committees, which a lot of local governments are run by, and which, you know, is kind of rather consensual form of government. And they'll simply be held to account by the councillors. And this was really an idea that was introduced by New Labour at the same time as the Greater London Mayor, which we'll come back to in 2000. Trouble is, however, that one of the stipulations that New Labour had for this idea was that before you have a directly elected mayor, you had to have a local referendum. And you only introduced the directly elected mayor if there was a success in the referendum. As you can imagine, however, quite a lot of local councillors were none too keen on this idea because it was going to take power away from them. And what we discovered is that actually of there were 54 of these referendums until now. Actually, we've given up on them. And of those 54 referendums, only 17 actually produced a vote in favour. And in fact, in four cases where there was a successful vote, a subsequent referendum reversed this. So we still got a few of them. There will be one such election in Salford at the beginning of May. But this has all well gone onto the back burner as compared with, well, first of all, the Greater London morality, which is still with us. There was a referendum in favour of 1999, and now we have it. But then, Rachel, to gain another innovation of the Conservative Democrat government, which is introducing so-called metro mayors for combined authorities.
So just before we talk about the mayoral elections, what powers do they have? There are now 11 mayoralties, many of which are quite new, and they vary enormously in their powers. There's this kind of bewildering patchwork matrix of the different powers that each of the mayoralties have, depending on specific devolution deals that they have negotiated with central government. Outside of London, the two most significant remain Greater Manchester and the West Midlands, which is Birmingham, but also a number of other cities around the West Midlands, who are now, for the first time, and this is very new, going to get a single funding settlement. So rather than having 30 different bits of money and bits of funding pots, some of which they have to bid for, all of which have conditions, they're going to start being treated a bit more like a government department. So they'll get a single lump of money. over several years that they can spend across a whole range of their priorities. Although, as any central government department will tell you, their power is much more limited by the Treasury than they would like. So we shouldn't exaggerate this, but they will get a big single pot. And they're also part of this pilot where they can keep 100% of business rates, which is a property tax that is levied on companies on the high street or in an area, and that will go direct to the Mountie. So they have the biggest tax raising powers. They have other precepts, additions that they can charge, but the business rates are quite significant, and they have more flexibility on how they're able to spend money. They are still much more limited in their power than their counterparts in major European or American cities would be.
But one role, of course, they also have, which as it were is not in legislation, is they are potentially at least spokespersons for the interests of their area.
Absolutely.
And obviously the two in particular who I think have been particularly successful in the last 4 or 5 years, one is Andy Burnham, who of course used to be a frontbench Labour MP, went off to become Mayor of Greater Manchester. The other is Andy Street in the West Midlands. Some of the others, not so
well
known.
And I think a third would be Ben Houchen, actually. Ben Houchen at Tuesday.
Absolutely. And I think we of course, particularly saw some of this during the pandemic, when during one of the phases of which the government, for England at least, was trying to introduce different rules for different parts of the parts of England. And you certainly saw plenty of lobbying by some of the mayors against the particular regulations for their area. And it's an important point, of course. It's a thing that any politician who is in charge of any territorial unit, whether it's Scottish government or English morality, whatever, in the end, your first loyalty has to be to your area and not to your party. And Boris Johnson, to give him credit, was often willing to indicate his sometimes disagreement with what the UK government under David Cameron was promoting for London. But that, of course, is also one of the reasons why, in the end, central government isn't always quite so keen on the idea, particularly once they get into power.
And I mean, the other role that these mayors have, and you see this most visibly with Ben Houchen and Teesside, is by being a spokesman for their area, they're quite effective at drawing in foreign investment and creating a sense of momentum around industrial change in their area. But you're right, John, there is always this tension in government between the leader, so that will be presumably Keir Starmer, and the other key political figures who don't fall neatly into their party structures. And I think one of the challenges that British politicians and central government face is precisely because they haven't given very significant powers and very significant tax-raising powers to mayoralties, the mayors can very legitimately and very persuasively blame central government for all of their problems while taking credit for the successes. I mean, that would be my view, that if they want the mayors to complain less, then they're going to need to give them more
yeah,
power.
And of course, just before Easter, the Labour Party did come up with latest plans for saying they would have more devolution, although they weren't clear as to whether or not mayors were going to be a part of this. But as it were, history is littered with oppositions calling for the devolution of powers while they're in opposition, but then discovering the obstacles once they are in power. So if indeed we do get a change of government, we will wait and see whether or how much of this actually happens.
I've also noticed that there is no bigger advocate for devolution than a former chancellor. As soon as they've left the Treasury, they think this is the most important reform that could possibly be enacted. But while they're there, they seem to quite like all the power that it entails.
Anyway, one of the things that mayors in general, including metro mayors, it was hoped was going to produce was indeed to, you know, because they're supposedly more visible, that more people would turn out elections, because turnout in local elections in England, often, you know, only around the 35% mark, tends not to be that high. There's a bit of evidence in London that maybe it's had a bit of an impact. So if you take the 6 mayoral contests in London since 2000, the turnout on average has been 40%. That compares with a 38% turnout over the same period in the London borough elections, which take place in between the London mayoral elections. But if you look at the last round of metro mayor elections outside of London, turnout 2021, 34%. Very much in line with the turnout that you get for local elections.
And John, roughly how does that compare to national elections?
Well, turnout we would normally expect these days to be running in the high 60s, around 70%. So, you know, it's around a half of what we would expect in a general election, even though turnout in general election these days tends to be rather lower. And although we've already noted some examples of people who have mayors have definitely created a personal vote, Boris Johnson, Ben Houchen, and of course there was also the very famous election of Stuart Drummond in Hartlepool, who stood as Hangus the Monkey, who was Hartlepool Town's football mascot, which, shall we say, was sometimes quoted as a certain amount of ribaldry and kind of suggesting that maybe these elected mayors were not always that serious. But again, the problem is that while, you know, some people don't vote in line with the way they would vote a general election, about three quarters of people in mayoral elections do so. So again, the extent to which these elections depart from the national scene at whatever particular time the election is taking place, it exists, but it's limited. But I guess that takes us really, Rachel, to the local elections on the 2nd of May.
Because I think this is one of your core points, John, which is that local elections, and we've stayed resolutely local so far in this conversation, are in this country at least as much a verdict on how people feel about the national government and the national party as it is about how they feel about the performance of local councillors or local councils.
Yes, to a degree. But certainly, to some extent, more so now than was once the case. A couple of things have really happened. The crucial development probably was a reform of local government in 1973 that Edward Heath's government introduced. So much of the structure of local government that we have now, although it's been tinkered with in an incremental fashion ever since, but the foundation of the current structure of local government in England goes back to a reform in 1973 when what hitherto were lots of fairly small urban district councils and borough councils and rural district councils were amalgamated into much bigger areas. And in creating much bigger areas, what you then did, of course, you made it more difficult for independent councillors who might want to represent their local village or whatever, to be able to stand effectively. And the political parties get much more involved in local elections in the wake of that. And then the other thing that happens, and this actually started from about the 1980s, and I actually played a role in this, is that once we also began to have the advent of the PC, believe it or not, there is a link between how we report local elections and the emergence of the personal computer. The emergence of the personal computer meant that I and a guy called Clive Payne could turn up with the BBC and say, if you can get some of the local election results, we'll put them in our computer for you and we'll be able to tell you how well or badly the parties are doing on local election night. And this is where...
When you became our national guru, John.
This is where the tradition of looking to local elections as evidence of how well the parties are doing begins to emerge. Because they're by this stage, the party, at least in urban England, are fighting them predominantly on a party political basis, and voters are beginning to vote on a party political basis. Now, not all voters do. It's just under 80% who vote in line with the national position. And certainly since the late 1980s or so, the Liberal Democrats always do better in local elections than they do in national elections. And actually, the Greens do so these days. And even actually now, there's been some revival of independence. But it's still the case, and I'm afraid, that when you see the reporting of the local elections on May the 3rd, indeed May the 4th, the counts will go on for quite a while, most of it is going to be interpreted almost inevitably, because a general election is coming down the track, as to what it tells us about the standing of the parties. And it usually tells us enough to provide some valuable clues.
In a moment, we'll discuss how the main parties might fare in the local elections. First, though, a short break.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Okay, so John, how cataclysmic is this going to be for the Conservatives? And what should we be looking out for?
Well, the first thing you always have to know about local elections and to interpret the headlines is you have to ask yourself, when were the seats that are being contested this year previously contested? And the answer to that question for most of the local elections, certainly all the mayoral elections, all the PCC elections, and the majority of the local council elections, although not all of them, the answer to that question is 2021. Now, 2021 is politically light years away. If I say to you that on the same day as the local elections took place, the Conservatives under Boris Johnson, who was then still our Prime Minister, won Hartlepool in a parliamentary by-election from Labour, you will realise that we are looking at the era when the Conservatives were enjoying a post-vaccine bounce, when Sir Keir Starmer's relationship with Angela Rayner was somewhat shaky, and his personal popularity was beginning to go down the tubes. And the Conservatives were 6 points ahead of Labour in the opinion polls.
So wait, John. So this was after the final lockdown. The vaccines were coming on stream.
We're getting out of lockdown at this point.
We're getting out of lockdown. The vaccines are coming on stream.
Yeah.
There's been no Partygate or similar scandal yet.
Correct.
And Keir Starmer is considered not to be making debt. This was the period where Boris Johnson was considered to be, what was the term, like squatting like a toad across the centre of politics.
Indeed, you could read articles in your Sunday newspaper saying how he was planning to be in office for 10 years.
I'm sure he was.
But there you go, you see, beware what you wish for. The Conservatives even made a net gain of council seats, which governments rarely do because, you know, governments tend to be unpopular in the middle of the term and they voters take it out of them on local elections. So the problem they have this year is that for the most part, they are defending this high baseline. And the point is that if you then look at what happened in local elections in 2022 and 2023, what you discover is that, you know, the performance of the parties, when you start adding up the votes and do what we do on election night, which is project these results into what we think would be a national vote share for the parties. Well, in 2021, Tories, according to this measure, 7 points ahead. Last year, in contrast, the Tories were 9 points behind. Now, not so bad as the opinion polls, and that's because the Liberal Democrats do better. But you can see the turnaround. So even if the Tories do no worse than they did last year, they're going to lose quite a lot of seats. One projection says they could lose half the council seats that they're trying to defend. They could also lose up to a half of the 16 councils where they've got control they're trying to defend. So you can see the headlines for Rishi Sunak are unlikely to be that good.
And this is where we get into what I find the most boring game in politics, which is the expectations game that runs through the newspapers and the run-up to the local elections, where the Conservatives say, well, if we keep even one council, it will be a triumph. It will actually be us defeating expectations. And Labour say, if we gain even one council or one councillor, it will be a triumph because we'll be defeating expectations. So each party tries very hard to anchor
indeed
the press around a result that they think they will beat.
But it doesn't always work. And last year was a famous example. So last year, Colin Rawlings and Michael Thrasher, who do a lot of work on local elections and write it up for the Sunday Times, they did a projection. They said, well, we think the Conservatives are going to lose 1,000 seats. And then, however, the position of the Conservatives in the opinion polls improved a bit after the, after that. And so the Conservatives quite happily trumpeted this and say, look, you know, it's really difficult. It's in midterm, blah, blah, blah. But the experts are saying we're going to lose 1,000 seats, all right? And that really was trying to depress expectations. And, of course, what the Conservatives were really saying was, of course, we're going to do better than that. We're not going to lose 1,000 seats, and therefore we're going to be able to claim we're making progress. Well, lo and behold, late on the Friday evening, just as the nation's attention was about to turn to the coronation of King Charles, which was scheduled for the following day, and what I always thought was a rather funny piece of timing by Buckingham Palace, we discovered that the Conservatives had indeed lost 1,000 seats. Behind which, by the way, there was an important message. And it goes back also to some of the polling we've seen, including some of the polling that came out over Easter. And the crucial thing about those local elections wasn't just simply that the Conservatives were doing badly, but where they were doing badly. The Conservatives were losing ground most heavily in places they were trying to defend. And that, together with the fact that voters were voting tactically for either Labour or Liberal Democrats, wherever they were best able to defeat them. That's why the Tories lost 1,000 seats, even though actually in terms of vote share, they didn't do so badly as some people had anticipated. And the point is that recent polling, that somewhat now infamous poll that appeared in the Daily Telegraph funded from a somewhat obscure Conservative source that said the Conservatives would get 160 seats. The reason why the poll at the over the Easter weekend actually said it could be less than 100 seats. The two things that those polls have in common is very clear evidence, according to them, that the Conservatives are losing ground, above all, in places where they are previously strongest. And that's why, if indeed, but it's a big if at the moment, Labour do end up with a 19-point lead in a general election, the Conservatives could indeed find themselves in a very, very weak position indeed. So one of the things to look out for in these local elections, it's not just how well the parties do overall, but where do they lose? And in particular, do we see another repetition of this pattern of the Conservatives losing ground most heavily in places that they were trying to defend? That's what will really be bad news for them.
Now, you've mentioned so far in talking about this, Labour and the Liberal Democrats, but when you look at the national voting intention, I'm just looking at the latest YouGov one, the Lib Dems are fourth and quite nearly fifth in national voting intentions. It's Reform, yes, which is on 15 points to, in this poll, Lib Dem 9, and Green only 1 point behind, which is kind of, I suppose, the far left version of Reform, on 8 points. So how does Reform's rise change what is plausibly going to happen in the local elections? And do the Greens matter at all?
The Greens do matter. The Greens do now have a significant number of councillors, and they will in particular be focusing on somewhere like Bristol, where they are hoping to pick up the Bristol Central parliamentary seat. So you can expect the Greens particularly to be focusing on certain areas where they've got a parliamentary interest. And the Greens gradually have become more successful in local elections. The fascinating question is Reform, and this is something that's only going to become clear later this week when we start to get details of nominations. One of the key reasons why the Conservatives are losing ground more heavily in parliamentary constituencies where they were previously strongest is because Reform did not fight most of these constituencies back in 2019, i.e. the then Brexit Party. So even if Reform aren't doing that well, by intervening in these seats and taking votes disproportionately from the Conservatives, they cause the Conservatives particularly difficulty in places to try and defend. Now, interestingly, although Reform did fight some of the Police and Crime Commissioner elections back in 2021, it's anticipated, they're certainly saying they're not proposing to fight those. Now, at the moment, the Conservatives are at risk of losing perhaps one in three of the 30 PCCs they're trying to defend. If Reform don't stand, then maybe the Conservatives won't do so badly. How far Reform have the ability to put up much in the way of local council candidates? That, again, I think is a big question mark. And again, that may also help the Conservatives because voters who at the moment are minded to switch from Conservative to Reform, who find they don't have Reform on the ballot paper, Will they go back to the Conservatives? Reform are fighting in London. They're fighting the morality. They're fighting the Greater London Assembly election, where again, at the moment, the Conservatives are at risk of perhaps recording their worst result yet. London, frankly, is, you would think, is the last place where Reform would focus, because London is very much more, relaxed about immigration, predominantly pro-EU. This is not natural Reform territory. So the one thing that might help the Conservatives is whether or not in the end Reform are not, in these local elections at least, not challenging them in many of the places where they could be vulnerable. That, of course, doesn't mean to say that they Reform might not still be a problem for the Conservatives come the general election.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at this, Reform are at 21% in the North and in the Midlands and 9% in London. So it doesn't feel like a very major threat. Although it's not nothing.
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, the point is, even in the poll at the Easter weekend, Reform 8.5%, which is kind of lower than many polls. But again, if you look at the innards of that, that meant the equivalent of Reform going up by about 9 points in the average Conservative-held constituency, as compared with the fact that Brexit Party were, in most cases, at naught back in 2019.
So, John, I guess that you've already mostly answered this, but I think it will be interesting for listeners. When watching the local elections, what do you think are going to be the most interesting signs for the general election later this year?
Well, point one is, in the end, don't get too focused on claims about gains and losses of seats. The relationship between seats and votes in local government elections is even more complicated than it is at Westminster. I mean, not least because, you know, district councils, where, you know, half the seats are being contested, the wards are much smaller than the wards in the big city council. So you can get a very distorted picture. Listen out for two things. One is what we call the projected national share. Last year, Labour, only 35%. Some of us felt, actually, Labour could have done better. Conservatives on 26%, however, doing pretty badly. Has that gap widened or narrowed? If that gap has narrowed, then the Conservatives can take some comfort that maybe, even though the opinion polls are suggesting their position is somewhat weaker now than it was 12 months ago, maybe that's not the case. So that's point one to look out for. What is the big overall picture? And it's these projections into a projected national vote that gives the cleanest picture. And it enables you to compare the results this year, not just with 2021, but with last year, the year before, etc. So you get a much more rounded picture. And then the second thing to look out for is what I said, is what is the geography of the change? And in particular, do we get evidence of the Conservatives losing ground most heavily in places where they're previously strong? This is what the opinion polls suggest. But also, and this is something that opinion polls cannot pick up at this stage, because voters make the decision to vote tactically late in the day, do we get evidence that in wards where the Democrats are the principal challengers to the Conservatives locally, it's their vote that goes up most, and in wards where Labour are the principal challengers to the Conservatives locally, it is Labour's that goes up most? That was in evidence last year. And I again say to you, as you know, I'm rather long in the truth in all of this. The last time that we saw those two patterns in combination in local elections, i.e. the Conservative vote going down more in places where they were previously strongest, and anti-Conservative tactical voting in local elections, it was, of course, in the local elections in the run-up to the 1997 general election, at which those two patterns also appeared and ensured that the Conservatives ended up with only 165 seats. So you can see why, for those of us who realise that at the end of the day, it isn't just the votes that parties get that matters, but under our first-past-the-post system, where they get them, that is crucial, that's what we'll be looking out for, having collected a lot of votes and got our personal computers out and got started analysing them.
I think, given the state of recent polls, 165 seats might be a relief for the Conservative Party right now. And presumably this is also why there is already an argument raging in the newspapers about whether Rishi Sunak should be replaced after the local elections, because they are anticipating the potential of this result and therefore hoping, or at least some of them are hoping, that a new leader might turn around their fortunes.
Rachel, the whole of the journalistic world is now in a febrile atmosphere about what's going to happen between now and the general election. And if anybody says anything that might suggest they know when the election is going to be, it immediately becomes major headlines, even though, as in the case of Jeremy Hunt, all he was doing was talking about the difficulty of the timing for the next spending review. Or if in my case, you say, I think it's 99% likely that Labour will form the next administration, immediately,
I saw that.
immediately it becomes headlines. The truth is, some people are now thinking, oh, maybe we could have an election, you know, in the summer. I mean, I think, you know, to be honest, I think everybody should sit down and, you know, probably just accept that the most likely thing is the most boring thing, which is that probably Mr. Sunak will survive the local elections and that the election will indeed be in the autumn, probably in November, in the due fullness of Mr. Sunak's time.
I think I can confidently predict that every newspaper in the country is going to ignore that advice. That's it from Trendy for this week. I'm Rachel Wolfe.
And I'm John Curtis. We'll be back again next week.
Tortoise.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.